Welcome to the Phoenix Cast, a podcast about cybersecurity, technology, and innovation issues in the military. We are your hosts, John.
And Kyle.
I'm a U.S. Marine, and the opinions expressed on the cast are my own, not official military policy.
And the opinions expressed by me are also my own, not those of my employer or any other organizations I have to be associated with.
For today's episode, we're joined by special guest Mike Holdridge. Thanks for joining us. Can you give us a quick intro?
Sure. I'm Mike Holdridge. I'm a communications officer. Just as a background on my history as to how I got here, started out in 1st MLG, where I was the technical control platoon commander in Combat Logistics Regiment 17. Then I served as the communications officer for Combat Logistics Battalion 5. When I PCS'd, I moved over to Fort Meade, where I worked at the Defense Information Systems Agency, where I worked in the Satellite Engineering Division. And then in the director's commander's action group. When the new director came in and the CAG was disbanded, I moved over to Joint Force Headquarters, Department of Defense Information Networks, working on the Defensive Cyberspace Operations Watch Floor. Following that assignment, I moved down to Camp Lejeune, where I served as a company commander at 8th Communications Battalion. Then I moved over to 2nd Marine Division, where I served as the G6 Operations Officer. During the time with the G6, I deployed out with Task Force 61/2. When I finished my time with 2nd Marine Division, I just PCS'd recently. But the point that I wanted to talk about during this podcast is specifically the time that I spent out with 2nd Marine Division and Task Force 61/2.
Mike, thanks so much for coming on. And before we start the formal part of the cast, I always like to toss Kyle a little bit of a, hey, do you still have your game with you? So I'm not certain we have talked about the MLG before on this podcast. So Kyle, chance to embarrass yourself or come in as the savior. The MLG is part of the MAGTAF, and there's two acronyms. Please explain what these things are.
Ooh, MLG Marine Logistics Group and the MAGTAF Marine Air Ground Task Force, right? Like, I feel like you just gave me softballs. But also want to call out Mike. That is one of the least acronymy intros we've ever had on this. I want to thank you on behalf of the acronym police everywhere for that introduction. And also to call out, dude, you've been around. Like, that is an impressive collection of all the Pokemon necessary to win the game when it comes to being a badass, well-rounded combo.
And by major.
Yeah, this is like not a small feat. And because of that, right, like you just PCS'd, and now where are you headed now?
Are you able to say? I'm at the Marine Corps Warfighting Lab.
Okay. So more at the like leadership level and the getting things done level now and out of the Fleet Marine Forces. Okay. So I want to dive into this for the first question at the technical and higher level, speaking of like where you've come from and all the experience that you have and where you're going to. We had some battalion level folks come on previously in the cast. We've got the Cuomo talk in the show notes for all the listeners here. And can you talk us through that glue that is required at the battalion and above to connect all those things to the higher level command and how that is influenced?
Absolutely. So, when Scott Cuomo was on here, he talked a lot about the innovation that occurred at the individual battalion level. The Lance Corporals doing absolutely amazing things in order to work through there. It was great. There was a lot of stuff that we had to do on the back end that was completely invisible to the rest of the people, because that's what it should be as commos. Everything should be invisible to the user.
That's how you know you're doing your job right, right?
Exactly. Yep. I don't want anyone to know who I am because things are working out correctly. But that provided a very unique problem in running all the stuff for recon, counter recon that Scott Cuomo was talking about, just because it really forced us at a much lower level than we're used to integrate in with the Navy, to build that connection in there. There's a lot of challenges that we had to build out within 2nd Marine Division, 2MEF, and then when I got out there with Task Force 61-2, to build that relationship, to build that interoperability, to be successful.
And Mike, can you talk us through, because what I just heard in my mind was architecture changes. Can you talk us through all the stuff Scott came on and talked about? What did you all have to do to make that possible? You don't have to go specifically into every technical detail, but give us a rough general idea. And then I just want to know, as a commo, did you get challenged to think differently, or was this honestly just like a, hey, I'm used to integrating technology and this was just another technology?
So there's a lot that changed about the way that we design our architectures. One of the biggest things is that from my perspective, we've had a foundational change in how we developed these just because we are used to flowing into a theater that had a pre-established architecture that we fell in on. We maintained that architecture for the amount of time that we were in country, and then we left. And when we were back in the States, we would build discrete training architectures to execute various exercises, an ITX, the integrated training exercise, Steel Knight, Desert Scimitar. Those are just the ones that I dealt with when I was out on the West Coast, but the same thing for the East Coast and the Oki units as well. Very discrete architectures. We've transitioned because we're not flowing into a standing architecture in country to maintaining a standing architecture back here in the rear. It really required a 24/7, 365 view as to how we maintain these things, which then led us to this idea that as we're building these things, it has to be able to hit the full range of everything that we do. It has to be flexible. It has to be scalable, survivable, redundant, simple. Most importantly, it has to be repeatable. And I do want to clarify as well, as we're getting into this, this is not something that I did personally on all this. There was a huge group of people who were involved in this one.
So, Mike, I want to double click on that a little bit, because this is like the tale as old as time, is that do you go forward and connect to an established network in country, or do you run it all yourself, right? We've gone back and forth with this on a service-wide level, on a more national, you know, do you have what tactical cloudlets, is what we talked about multiple times in the cast before. It's kind of a running joke now, everybody, but the challenges that you face in this is when you go forward in theater, there's always a team that's out there, a NOC or an operations center that is providing this to your forward units, so that when you land in theater, you just go to them and they give you the info packet or the PDF on your Nipper side, and you figure out how you're going to connect in. And it's like you're inheriting someone else's problems, but you also get to avoid a lot of problems because of that. And it makes setup super fast and it's easy to train to. But what you're talking about here, Mike, is that when you did this for the battalion levels, you had to do all of that stuff. The burden of uptime and SRE and DevOps and deployments and security and accreditation and all these things now flowed into your lap, where now you are becoming this sort of higher level forward deployed support entity, even though your unit is still remaining in the rear, or that you have other elements of that remaining in the rear. Am I hearing that right? And am I kind of hitting through some of those challenges?
So somewhat. Because we started off kind of with this idea of the architecture that we used back in the States is what we wanted our units to use when they were forward. So you're right in that it was on us to do all of those aspects, but we were able to do that before that was needed. So when a unit left from Camp Lejeune to go overseas, not much changed for the lower level unit, because we wanted to reduce the burden that existed on that lower level unit, because they have enough to do just maintaining things. Let the higher echelons deal with the stuff in a standing basis.
And then I had a follow-up question here too. So, you know, kind of mentorship moment, so that the commos that are listening to this can kind of hear it. Did somebody wrap their arm around you and say, hey, Mike, we need to make a change. There are some things that need to be done differently. Or did you, like, you know, go out on the metaphorical, 3-mile run and fall flat on your face and like, ooh, I'm not doing this again? How did you even get to, I want to try something different?
I was incredibly lucky in that I had a fantastic group of chief warrant officers that worked throughout 2MEF.
Can you say that one more time?
Slow. Kyle is dancing.
Oh, yeah, like, yeah.
Stop the podcast. Kyle took off his headphones and started dancing around when he said that.
Sorry, go ahead. Yeah. Chief warrant officers are the best. Carry on.
Yeah, absolutely. Chief warrant officers, I mean, they are a subject matter expert in these things for a specific reason. And it is very important that when we get into these things, that we are letting the subject matter experts do the thing that they are a subject matter expert in. My job as the OPSO is to give the overall view, like we are heading east, and let the engineers tell me how we're going to get east. But as we got into this and we started talking about this new style architecture, and it was those incredibly brilliant chief warrant officers that spent a lot of time with a whiteboard explaining to me why things were different today for so many different reasons. And honestly, some of the later on perspectives that I've developed off of this one were actually because I got yelled at by a chief warrant officer because I was making his life unnecessarily more difficult by not instituting some of these aspects.
I want to endorse making their life a little bit more difficult from time to time.
That keeps us on our toes, you know, sharp.
If it's more difficult for a purpose, absolutely. But if it's more difficult because we're doing what we've always done and not adapting, that's where we deserve to be yelled at.
100%. All right. So we keep hearing people talk about this word integration. I'm going to pick on that for just a quick second. And it's almost becoming the new, why don't you just send it to the cloud kind of phrase of it's a catch-all, right? It means so much to so many people. When you talk about integration, and especially as we're talking about these challenges that you faced, what does that mean to you? What are your thoughts on how we are throwing around that term?
So yeah, that was a key aspect of this, was really trying to figure out how to build in naval integration, which you're 100% right. It's becoming one of those terms that nobody knows what it actually means. It means something different to every person.
Yeah, it's just like, we're going to synergize this, right? Like, let's...
Exactly. And I know that my definition is not doctrinal, so I know there's a lot of people who are not going to like it. But from my view, there's a significant difference that exists between integration and interoperability. The Marine Corps is fantastic at interoperability. We are terrible at integration.
All right, just so define those for me.
Yeah. So to me, integration is understanding the people and the processes that exist at the joint or coalition level, whereas interoperability is the technical ability to connect those things. So an example of that, I'm going to go with an incredibly simple example and then to a more complicated example of this one. But an example of issues with integration, the very first meeting that I went to when we got out to 6th Fleet, when I was under Task Force 6212, one of the first N6 meetings, I got asked if we had released our task prom message yet. That was all I got, was task prom message. I didn't want to look like an idiot, so I wrote it down in my book, and I ran back to the rest of the Marine staff, and was like, has anybody ever heard of a task prom? Actually, what I asked was, have we released a task prom yet? And nobody understood.
Dear civilians, you are not the only ones who are completely lost in acronyms.
Yeah. So, yeah, 100%. None of us knew what this task prom was. I asked everybody on my staff, including people who had done multiple MU deployments and worked with the Navy a lot. I finally went back to the N6 tail between my legs, asked them to explain it to me like I'm 5, and they basically explained it as, oh, it's your message when you get into theory, and you're saying, I am this unit, and I am taking over as this task force. And these units underneath me are taking over as these task groups. And basically what it boiled down to me is, it's the Navy's version of our Annex A, which is our organizational annex that says the command relationships and who's who within an operation. So even that little bit of understanding how those language aspects work, we had a massive confusion on. To make it even more complicated, the Navy releases their task prom message, which stands for their promulgation message. It's not even an acronym. It's just an abbreviation. It's just a shortened version of what it is they're trying to say.
It feels like a trap.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, specifically designed to walk you down a terrible path.
Exactly.
Yes. So, I'm also going to tell all the listeners here, I've never heard of task prom before, and I'm Googling it in real time as we're recording this cast, and every single search result that I've tried 4 or 5 different things now, and I've even asked Bard, everything comes down to talking to me about Navy balls, because it's talking about the prom, and like, do you have a prom in the military? That's literally where it's taking me down, is like dances and other forms of celebration.
Have you signed up for a Navy prom now?
I guess so. Like, who's going to be homecoming queen? That's all I want to know, right? Like, is there some sort of court? I have so many questions about the task prom.
So they have this message that needs to be sent out that's going to be saying, I am this unit coming into theater on this. They release that on the system called C2OIX, or the Command and Control Office Information Exchange System, which is basically the Navy's version of our AMHS, or Automatic Message Handling System. that is designed for the limitations that the Navy has, because C2OIX is incredibly bandwidth efficient, which you need when you're talking to ships on a degraded connection. On top of that, they refer to the language, the addressing that goes to these units as their PLAD, or plain language address, that goes in there. And all of those things are examples of the challenges that we have in integrating with the Navy's process. Because fast forward, about a year after I get back from Task Force 612, we're getting ready to do a fleet battle problem. And one of the questions the Navy asked, because they use the C2OIX system for all of their messages, to include their logistics messages, their fires messages, their comms messages. That's what they release their OPTAS comms on, for anybody who's done any kind of amphibious operations before, which is the Navy's version of an Annex K, or our communications annex. We're trying to figure out how to talk with the Navy system, and someone asked out what a unit's PLAD was. Nobody knew on the Marine Corps side what the hell this was, and I finally had to come in over the top and say, it's your AMHS address. That's what it is that they're asking for. So that is an example from a very, very simple aspect of the challenges that we have with integration with the Navy. On a more complicated side of this one, the joint fires process is something that exists at the joint level without the Marine Corps being involved. Because when you look at, for example, the European theater, where you have a Navy command and control element that is always out there, 6th Fleet, you have an Air Force element that is always out there, the 603rd Air Force, and you have an Army element. I can't remember which corps is permanently stationed within Europe, but all of them have to integrate things like ballistic missile defense, joint fires, all of these other aspects to it. So those processes exist before the Marine Corps gets involved. Trying to figure out how we integrate into that when we get into theater and not over-marine the system, not reinvent the wheel, was the challenge we ran into. And that's where interoperability comes into it as well.
So one, I'm having an awful lot of flashbacks to my MEW days, and they're not positive, lovely flashbacks. They're painful. This hurt very badly flashbacks. And you might be listening at home and thinking to yourself, this sounds like a lot of admin stuff. I don't think I care about this. Here's the deal. Imagine your Amazon data center floated across the water and transitioned
by design.
Floated across the water and then transitioned between service providers. And then think through the million changes on the network that just triggered. That's what Mike is talking you through right now. And it's easy to miss that it's not just Task Force XYZ now has these units instead of these units. Yawn, who cares? They have some IPs and they need to be routed and their DNS needs to change and these people are going to handle it instead of these type of people. There's an awful lot of tech behind all of this stuff for things to just keep working so that you don't have to know who Mike is.
And John, to make it even more complicated than that one. So when you get into the as I was talking about with the joint fires process, the things like that that exist before we get in there, you realize as you start to talk through this that all of those different things have different message formats that they're prescribed in. So think about when you talk about a message format, imagine a database that has all of these different pieces that can go into this one. And these different message formats look at different segments of that database and discard all the other ones. So it can be a real challenge because, for example, the Navy does firing, does naval targeting, joint targeting, all that kind of stuff off of J series messages. That's what it's called. J for joint series messages. Whereas Marine Corps artillery units that we're talking about using as shooters for all these different sensors use K series messaging, or also known as VMF, variable message format devices, because we built this off for a FATIDS, which is the Advanced Field Artillery Tactical Data System that we bought off of the Army
Flashback.
To do cannon firing. Obviously, cannon firing off of a stationary target is very different than trying to target a moving vessel or a moving aircraft, because they use this for air targeting as well. Completely different. K-series and J-series do not inherently talk to each other, which means that something has to translate that language between them. And this is where we really have a problem on the Marine Corps integration side of this, because we're talking about putting smaller and smaller units out there to integrate into the joint force without planning for the integration of those messaging formats between each other. So, for example, when we're talking about the J-series to K-series messaging, obviously that system exists within the MAGTAF right now as it is, because how else would the MEF be able to plug into a joint force? So the MEF fires and effects coordination cell, or the Division Fire Support Coordination Center, the FEC and the FSCC, both run a program called JDOCS, or the, I want to make sure I get this acronym correct, the Joint Automated Deep Operation Coordination System, which has a program inside of that that does translation from J to K. Fantastic. The problem is that program only exists, is only really used at the FEC and the FSCC. It's not used at an artillery battery that gets put out somewhere. There's nothing to say that it can't be used. It absolutely can be. It's a program that exists on a on any of our laptops, especially the JTCWs, the Joint Tactical COP Workstation laptops that we exist for all of our COCs. It's just, it's not something that we're trained to right now, because we haven't thought about how to enable integration from an interoperability standpoint. And then the message formatting that we're talking about gets even more confusing when you consider some of the other systems that we have. So TAC, as one that has been talked about a lot lately, and I know on the podcast a couple episodes ago, you had McTiss out here talking about TAC. TAC uses cursor on target message format. Our tactical COP servers use Gold Series messaging as the message format, which is the same message format that the Global Command and Control System, or the GEECS servers, use. So all of these things are using different message formats and different languages for them, which means ultimately they're pulling different information from the databases that do not overlap with each other. So that creates a problem if we don't plan that interoperability in beforehand.
Okay. So I want to first off acknowledge that that entire statement you just made from start to finish felt like a bad stand-up routine, but it's actually real, right? This just kept being more depressing as you walked down on this. Like all good things in technology, there's a relevant XKCD for this. It's number 927 for those of you at home, which is called standards. And it says, we have 14 standards. And someone gets mad and goes, man, we really shouldn't have 14 standards. We should have one universal standard. So you know what happens? Now you have 15 standards. And it just keeps going and keeps going and layering on. So it sounds like this is a beautiful and chaotic ballet of all these different units and all these different message formats all coalescing at higher command, so that higher command can do the API translation of all these message formats and then send them back. And I just use the word API, which means John's angel gets his wings. In order to do this, how do you handle that responsibility? How do you keep that timely?
So the problem is, it would make sense to have higher headquarters do those aspects, but it's not happening right now. We're not designing our architectures to actually do that. So we're designing them for each individual smaller unit to worry about doing that themselves.
Yeah, and I think I want to even highlight on Mike's point here. It's not that there's not already people designed to do this. It's just, what we're asking the force to do now is generally, and you see it everything, we want to push everything down to the battalion level. We want to make the infantry battalion more lethal. And this is what we're talking about, is pushing this kind of stuff down. And the problem is, previously, unless you were at the two places that Mike talked about, there was no reason for you to need to know this stuff.
And I would even say that the infantry battalion doesn't need to have that stuff resident in there, because there are ways that we can build this in, which is how we ended up building the architecture in Europe to support the recon, counter recon mission. All the stuff that was sitting on the back end that nobody knew about while the units were out there doing all their stuff, we built that in a very specific way to be able to do this, and pulling away a lot of the additional requirements. Because when they first went out there, when Scott Cuomo went out there with that unit, they were doing something brand new that we had never tried beforehand. And they were lucky that they had some absolutely brilliant Marines down there that were able to figure some of these things out before the rest of us were able to figure these things out. How to do the K-series to J-series translation, because I had never heard about that one before I was confronted with this problem set. We have since evolved that architecture to remove that requirement from the recon, counter recon unit, to remove that requirement from the artillery unit or anybody else who's going to be out there doing those things, because that's what makes sense in a larger architecture, rather than having all of these issues being solved individual. Because as I said before, like when we develop these architectures, we want it to be flexible, we want it to be scalable. Importantly, we want it to be repeatable. Because one of the problems we have with repeatability of these is we, you know, like the old expression, every Mew is the first Mew, because we've forgotten all the lessons that we learned from the last one. So people swap out, people PCS, and a new person comes in to be the LAR comma who's never had to deal with this stuff beforehand. And he's trying to figure out how to solve that problem for the first time. So we've been we've been striving to remove that requirement from the smaller unit. Because especially when you start thinking about how our data actually integrates to the joint force, you start to see efficiencies on how to build these out. So what I'm talking about with this one is, from a basic cybersecurity perspective, we're talking about this between the Marine Corps' network and the Navy's network. Basic cybersecurity, you're going to have firewalls, right? It's one of the basic things that you have to have in there that you're... You don't technically have to have them in there, but it would be an absolutely terrible idea not to have them in there. So you're going to have these firewalls. You're going to have them both on the Marine Corps side and on the Navy side. Whenever you're building a connection between those servers, you have to go into the firewalls and create the rules that are going to open the ports and protocols for this destination to get to this source. The way we're designing our architectures right now is for a whole bunch of them, basically every sensor and every shooter that's sitting within the Marine Corps, to do an individual firewall exemption of both the Marine Corps and the Navy side in order to connect up to the Navy to be able to pass the information to them.
Oh, that sounds like a seamless process that is incredibly smooth.
Yeah. So one, I just want to
be sarcastic.
Yeah. Yeah. I will give credit where credit is due. On the Marine Corps side, it actually works decently fast. I've seen it get done within a week.
Okay, so decently fast equals 1 week. there was an incredible second pause there of like, where is he going with this? Yeah. Okay, so what is not fast on the Navy side?
The Navy side is weeks to months sometimes.
Ooh.
So that's I can't.
I want to break in here, Kyle. If you told a customer, "Hey, I can give you world class security changes." How fast can you make a firewall change happen to differentiate you from competitors?
Are we talking
microseconds or are we talking seconds?
I mean, if I have
not no, weeks, right?
No, if I have no warning, it's like, how do I update the Terraform config and hit apply or Pulumi script or whatever? Or just like, how many seconds does it take me to go into the interface and click the buttons manually? But ideally, I say this with great hubris, everybody, you know, we have systems that we build that handle these sorts of things where you have, you know, registration systems that know who's on the network, identity systems that target and communicate within that system so that you can issue things like certificates and other stuff where, like the concept of a firewall, I'm 100% in agreement with. You need to have security that happens between enclaves and things like that. But this is where environments like zero trust or beyond corp setups come in heavy handy, where you can just have effective certificates that are registered with appropriate authorities. And when you request access to a particular system, it doesn't necessarily go, ooh, IP plus port equals access, yes. It goes, ooh, certificate matches authorization equals yes. And so that can help speed these things up exponentially.
And agree that that is the way of the future. The problem is when we're talking about integrating with the Navy, we're beholden to the Navy's timetable on this one. And 100%. One of the surprising things that I learned while I was out there is how many domains the Navy has. So obviously, we know from having done this one that each ship is its own individual domain. You have the Kearsarge.navy.mil, you have the Gunsonhall.navy.mil, all that kind of stuff. What I hadn't realized until I got out there is that each one of those COCOM architectures that they have, combatant command architectures, is a different, entirely different domain with entirely different support that provides to it. So as an example, I had not realized that NMCI was still a thing, because that is what the US.navy.mil runs off of. Whereas the European network, EU.navy.mil, is ran off of a system called OneNet, or overseas network, something along those lines. So completely different, which means that there's different policies, different rules for how that bureaucratic process goes into, because as we all know, or the three of us know, making a firewall rule change, even doing it the hard way, should be no less than 5 minutes. You're going to spend more time logging on than actually implementing the change, or more time making sure that they provided you the correct information and the time it takes for you to input the information. But within that bureaucratic process, that's where we get to weeks, if not months. So as an example of this one, I'm not going to quote it directly, but it can be looked up from anybody who wants to. The third MLR, so the third Marine Littoral Regiment training exercise, I think it was, after action report, that was basically their after-action report for the entire third MLR workup cycle, specifically mentions the obstacle that the Navy's firewall process creates. They even call out that the Marine Corps system works pretty well, decently well. Again, this is a process that only takes a few moments to do, but 3 to 5 days is what I've typically seen on getting those done from the MCOG. But the Navy's process is weeks, to the point that they specifically called out saying that basically if they got approved, they were last minute right before the thing kicked off. And this is with an element that we provided everything they could possibly need to include a full SPI at the MLR side to make sure everything was done correctly.
I'll add in, for anyone who's never been in any sort of joint environment or had to connect between different branches of service, that this is akin to having two completely separate companies in the outside world try to connect their networks together. Like, yes, they speak a somewhat common language of like who is promoted to what rank and things like that, but it really is akin to just two completely separate companies trying to connect their networks together and deconflicting all their security.
So using that analogy, that kind of scenario to it, was really what kind of built out the answer for how we resolve this in a flexible, scalable, and repeatable fashion. So what we hadn't realized until we started to look into it is you can actually put systems in there that kind of serve as an aggregator. And we kind of do that already with like a tactical COP server. Tactical COP servers feed each other in a hierarchical fashion. So you have the boundary tactical COP server that has multiple COP servers connected underneath it, and they feed all the information up and they receive everything that central one received from the other side.
Yeah, and a reminder to the listeners, tactical COP, that's your common operational picture. So if you think Google Maps and it's got all the different places you want to eat and you want to get gas or whatever, same general idea for the military. This is the map of where we are. If we know about some enemy units, we'll toss those down on there. And then dynamically, we have all our different systems talk and say, hey, I'm here. Hey, I'm here. And a commander can see all of this on a screen.
Absolutely. So what we will typically do for this is when we're not thinking about building in those efficiencies, you'll have a whole bunch of units doing direct connections from their regiment, from their division, from their battalion with their tactical COP server that they have, requiring a boundary change request at the Navy side and a request for firewall modification on our side to connect to the Navy to be able to feed these in there. However, when we think about building in those efficiencies, you can have that one system sitting up there, one firewall modification on both the Navy and the Marine Corps side, all of our systems on our side connecting to that one. The additional benefit to that is you know that that central one works already because you've established it beforehand. Because what we also don't talk about when we're trying to figure these out, we understand generally, I'll say just generally, we understand how the Marine Corps architecture is set up. I don't think that we understand it enough, but generally we understand how that connection works. We have no idea, once we get through the Navy's first firewall, all of the things that exist between that and the unit that we're trying to talk to. Just we have no idea. So whenever a problem comes up and you're trying to think about how to troubleshoot that problem and you want to test known good things as you're going through and really bracket where the problem could be in a informed troubleshooting process, imagine doing that where you don't understand half of the architecture and you have no idea where you can start bracketing problems to be.
Yeah, and one thing I want to add here. So one, you know, public service announcement. The point of all of this that we just said is not Navy bad, Marine Corps good. That if you took that away, let me reset us. That is not what we are saying. What we are saying is think of how hard this is. Because Mike just talked about getting the Marine Corps and the Navy to talk to each other. Well, surprise, the Navy is not just one thing. It is many things with many different architectures and many different processes that you got to work through. And remember from the last couple casts, we talked about we're not even saying JADC2, Joint All Domain Command and Control. We're not saying CJADC2 because we know when we go into the next fight, it's going to be a coalition. So to expand on what Mike is saying here, the Navy and the Marine Corps is an awful great start. Blue-green team, Semper Fidelis, yay. But it is us talking to all the rest of the DOD and then bringing in our coalition partners. Friends and family, if you think the Navy is hard, wait until you bring the rest of the folks in. Like, that is not going to be easy.
Take a moment to also appreciate the difficulty in taking your AWS data center and floating it around on the ocean, right? Like, yes, some of the stuff is crazy, but the Navy has very unique problems that literally no other force has, and communication systems that have to operate in ways that no other force has to operate. And again, not Navy bad, Marine Corps good in any way, shape, or form. Just like different problems require different solutions that have all been solved at different points in the last 20 years. And we have legacy upon legacy in all branches of the service. This is not picking on any in particular one. Even Space Force has inherited Air Force legacy problems at the end of the day. So it's a darn hard thing to connect all these folks up.
And the only reason why I'm focusing so heavily on the Navy for this one is because, one, we integrated our headquarters into a Navy headquarters, so I dealt with that firsthand. All of the lingering problems that we never even thought to deal with because of how rarely we call 6th Fleet. So there's that aspect to it. There's the direction from the Commandant to focus on naval integration and all of those kinds of things that we got from the previous Commandant, directing us to go that direction. So we had a direct access to this. But also, as we talk through the ideas of process improvement for this one and making it a repeatable solution, the concepts apply regardless of who it is that we're trying to talk to. If we're trying to do the things with the Army and the Air Force, again, the joint process already exists. We're just trying to figure out how to be interoperable with that joint process so we can enable the rest of the commanders to be integrated. But they still have the same J-series messaging that the joint series messaging that we're trying to integrate into. The aggregation that exists between our tactical COP server and their Geeks server, their global command and control server, is the same. So you can apply that to the Army, the Air Force. You can apply some of these concepts to the coalition and the combined forces as well, or even some of our allied partners, such as NATO, for example. You can start to apply some of these things in with them as well. So when I was talking through the aggregation aspect, I was focusing on the tactical COP servers building out that common operational picture, but that applies in with the J-Series messaging as well. We were able to find a system that enabled us to aggregate all of those J-Series messages from all of our sensors and shooters and flow all the stuff into there to be able to push that up to the Navy. So that request process to be able to rapidly flow a sensor or a shooter into theater goes from a, you're hoping it's a week or two, to a, in all honesty, it's about a 2-email process to reach out to the JITGO to get added into the link architecture, the tactical data link architecture required for you to be able to connect in with a J-Series asset. So the request process for this significantly decreases, which means our deployability into those areas significantly increases off of there, just by applying that concept of having a aggregated aspect into there. Which then, as I started to think about this problem, I was wondering, the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force, all those three headquarters that are constantly sitting in Europe, are able to integrate things like ballistic missile defense, able to integrate in, which ballistic missile defense requires those naval assets that are floating around just as much as it requires those Patriot missile batteries or any of the air defense things that the Air Force is bringing into this. So it requires all of those forces to be able to fully integrate it off of there. So how does a Navy ship pass targeting data or receive targeting data from an Army or Air Force sensor? Well, they apply the same aggregation aspect that I'm talking about using for the Marine Corps at the fleet headquarters level. So all of those ships within the 6th Fleet AOR have one connection up to the Navy, and the Navy passes all the stuff down to them, all that kind of stuff. Well, why is the Navy and the Air Force and the Army able to do that one so easily within that theater? Because they're always there. They have a regional C2 architecture set up there, which, by the way, we have a regional command and control element sitting out there anyway. But that regional C2 architecture, supported with all of the technical aspects, can be done really easily to basically, what this gets to is reducing the burden that exists on the unit that's deploying into theater. So you're able to maintain that architecture so the units are flowing in. That also gives you the ability to start building survivability as well, because then you can start to build in failover capabilities between the different COCOMs to make sure that if something were to happen to our connection, because again, we're talking about some of these have to be physical things that are sitting in theater for, because ultimately, if you're going to have a boundary position, a boundary location sitting in Europe to be able to do these things, you're going to have a firewall physically sitting in Europe to do that, whether it's a physical firewall or virtual firewall, traffic has to route through there. So it is sitting somewhere. You can physically attack that thing. You can physically attack the data center that is hosted in, something along those lines. So how do you fail over? Now, we build that into the rest of our architecture anyway, as we look at, for example, our internet access points between the Department of Defense information networks and the rest of the internet. We have failover, all that kind of stuff built in between multiple of these things. But you can build that same level of survivability in with a regional C2 construct to make sure that you can fail over between those, so that something happens to your European one, you can fail over to, say, a CENTCOM or a North American one to make sure that those units are still able to connect in regardless of what happens.
So, Mike, I want to ask a clarifying question for you on this. We have had this argument numerous times on the cast, which is the, do you put it all in the cloud or do you put all the servers local with the unit so that they can survive losing their higher level connection up to the joint command or the higher level regional authority and stuff like that. And I think that we've heard a lot of arguments in a lot of different ways around this. And I think that this is almost to the point of being like a, like the random pseudo debate you'd have in physics class over whether you can fly the plane if the runway's moving. You know, it's just this thought experiment that people have that gets your brain juices flowing. Like, should the servers be for deployment? Should the servers be back in CONUS? When we're talking about this joint interoperability and the ways that we have to communicate through, do you see that there is far less value in having the servers local with the unit when that means that they still won't be able to coordinate joint or coordinate inter-service or coordinate coalition without having some kind of higher connection anyway? And therefore, does that make the need far lower for having anything local in theater and the desire to have things remoted as much as possible?
So there's a few aspects to that one. So on the joint integration aspect to it, if you can't hit that boundary location to get through there to the Navy, to the Air Force, to the Army, whatever it is, then you're not coordinating with the joint force. So what's the point of having the servers local for you? The other aspect to this is I think this also brings in a misunderstanding of the newer style technology of what we're employing for all of these. So for example, we're talking about commercial satellite as a solution and actually thinking about the physical transport path for how those connections work and how they get back in, realizing that Starlink just provides you commercial internet. And how does commercial internet get back into the architecture for at least that first connection? Then you have to route in through those boundaries anyway for that commercial internet access point, because it's going to have to go through the DISA internet access points, through the JRS, the joint regional security stacks, on down into our architecture. It's going to have to go through that route anyway. So you can find efficiencies in how we're building out these architectures to build that in there. But it's all about risk reduction and the benefits that you're gaining off of this one. One of the challenges that we have right now is the number of things that are being put onto our young 0671s. And we are able to reduce the challenges of all the different things they need to understand by not having those servers located physically with them and having them remotely accessed.
So, Mike, I have a question for you. You invoked the Starlink principle, so I am throwing the card. Did you have a conversation with anybody about kind of what's in the national news lately? There's been a book that has come out that said Elon Musk shut down Starlink because of potential ethical implications, and completely understanding that now we've kind of become a little bit revisionist. But did you talk to your boss or anybody about, hey, Starlink does not equal DISA, and therefore, hey, can move faster, going to provide a bunch of theoretically better capability, but is different, you know, publicly traded company, can take political stances, et cetera. Is that a conversation that you had? Is that a conversation you had with your chief warrant officers?
So when we were executing this mission set, we did not have Starlink at the time. Starlink was not fully operationally capable, so we were not pursuing that at the time. We were actually using Chimetas at that time. Chimetas, at that point in time, was geosynchronous satellite only, but it had a on-the-move capability for it. Not as good as Starlink. However, what I'll say is we focused heavily on diversity in our transmissions assets to alleviate any of the concerns that are brought up by what you just mentioned. So we focused on using OneWeb, on Chimeta, on Starlink, on using HostNation LTE, HostNation commercial internet service providers. Military SATCOM still has a role to play into this one. So we have the ability to land FDMA shot, a frequency division multiple access, just to make sure that I'm checking you all the acronyms right now. But we're able to do an FDMA shot over to a DISA teleport site or a DISA step site to actually land there and route back directly into our architecture without having to bring TDMA out into theater, time division multiple access, which is absolutely terrible these days, but compared to some of the other things that we have. So we focused on the transmissions diversity aspect rather than having to have that, I won't say ethical conversation, but the conversation about ethics that other people are having about what it is that we do in the military.
Yeah. And you know, like you could call it ethics if you want to. I would just call it pragmatic, you know, to keep us non-political and whatever. A pragmatic conversation is, hey, there is a difference between government-owned and government-controlled. And not, hey, boss, here are some things you might need to know, especially, you know, because people can definitely get hooked on the low latency, high bandwidth juice. And then you're like, oh, no.
Well, it's got to be a yes and scenario too, in my mind, right? Like, we should not ignore any potential transmission media where in a conflict we could use it in order to gain access to higher level communications. It's as simple as that for me, right? Like, I don't want to ignore either side of that equation. We shouldn't go all in on civilian communication pathways any more than we should go all in on government communication pathways. They are both valuable in ways and in times and in access methods that we can train to. And we've got to make sure that we're not ignoring any tools that we could potentially have in our toolbox.
Absolutely. And this is one of the things that I get into whenever I have discussions on, like, for example, emissions control and all of those kinds of things. When we're talking about like using radio assets and this signature that emits out there, there has to be an honest conversation with what is likely to happen and what is the most dangerous course of action that could happen off of this one. And doing the hard work to be able to provide a risk-based assessment to the boss to let them, as the risk decision makers, make that decision. But I would almost say, intellectually lazy to not bring those things in there, understanding that it does provide us some benefits. We just have to do the hard work on our side as commos, do our job, and provide the risk-based assessment to our commander.
Okay, so Mike, I think we've hit most of the points that we wanted to hit on the cast, but what I wanted to do is kind of get a, hey, what helped you be successful here? Were there some books that you read? Was there a course that you went to? Or is there just any recommendations? Maybe you're like, hey, forget the books, take your chief warrant officers, make them go out for a 5-mile run and have them explain all this to you. Give us a technique here.
No chief warrant officer wants to go on a 5-mile run. Full disclosure. Zero.
I feel like that is not an accurate answer.
So I will say, one, incredibly important to listen to the subject matter experts. Give them the operational direction that you're heading and listen to them to find the answer that they're going to come up with. But ultimately, it comes down to listen to what it is that they're saying. The other aspect to it is diversity in assignments. So, for example, a lot of the perspective that I have on the larger scale of this, of how our architectures interact with other service in architectures, other coalition partner architectures, commercial satellites as service, all of those kinds of things, honestly, I only have a view of because I sat at a place at the Joint Force Headquarters Doden, which is a job that nobody wants and is a place that I would not highly recommend people to ask to go to, especially not as a young captain like I was when I went there. But
I'm sure it's great this summer.
It is just one of those things of by sitting in there and having to look at how we connect to the like outside of the Doden to the rest of the world and actually think about how our boundaries are set up from that aspect, it gave me an entirely different appreciation for how our architectures are built. And it forced me to think about the larger picture and not just how do I get services to my unit. So the only thing that I'll say is diversity in assignments, especially the ones that kind of suck a little bit. Sometimes you actually learn really, really good lessons for it. So whereas opposed to somebody who stays in one MSC for their entire career is really good at that one MSC, Major Subordinate Command for the acronym check. But somebody who stays in one MSC their entire career is really good at that, but they're missing out on the rest of the stuff. Not to say I want to build a MAGTAF officer, which was the lingo from years ago, but just the diversity in assignments gives you a different perspective.
Kyle, it is that time.
Ooh.
Hit us with the hottest of tactical hot takes.
Okay. Communication is hard. We've covered that 1,000 times on this podcast. And I want to challenge everybody that's out there. There's a book that I read a long time ago by Cal Newport, and it's called So Good They Can't Ignore You. And it basically talks about how your best bet is to get really good at one thing so that you can be really awesome at that one thing and get a job in that one thing for as long as humanly possible. And then I've read tons of other books that talk about how that's absolutely a terrible idea and that getting more diverse perspectives on things. There's a book called Range that's really awesome. That diverse perspectives on things makes you a better, more well-rounded human in general, whether that's your hobbies, your personal life, your relationships, your job, whatever. And My brain has shifted so much into the latter category of the more exposure you have to the more things, the better you will become at all things. Your ability to get a different viewpoint, a different perspective, different leverage from which you can execute whatever you need to execute. And I'll just challenge everybody that's out there, every commo that's listening to this, every chief warrant officer, everybody, get good at how the Marine Corps talks to the Marine Corps, and then immediately try to get good at how the Marine Corps talks to other branches of service, and then immediately try to get good at how our US DOD talks to other multinational defense forces that are out there. And you will learn a lot about how the world operates, how the world communicates, and then how you can use that to then go through another really great virtuous cycle of using that information to train your Marines to get better at how the Marine Corps communicates, so that you can get even more better at how the DOD operates, and you can get even more better about coalition. And when in doubt, Mike, I want to go back to the very first thing that you said. If you don't know the acronym, immediately leave the meeting and go find out the acronym. This is a valuable skill where sometimes you just can't Google stuff. So you got to do the caveman thing and go like walk into people's offices and pick up the phone and call folks and say, I really need some help to figure out a thing I don't know. Reminder to everybody, that is not a sign of weakness or a lack of intelligence. It is absolutely a sign of great intelligence to know when you don't know something and to try and go learn to fill in that gap. That's the hot take. Please keep learning.
Dear listeners, thanks for joining us. You can connect with us on social media by going to Twitter, I'm not going to say X, and following at USMC underscore TFPHOENIX. That's at USMC underscore Task Force Phoenix. Our editor is Sarah Clarkson, and marketing support is provided by Jake Osborne. You can support the cast by going to Apple Podcasts and giving us a 5-star review. I need more of those. Make this happen. And an accompanying comment. And with that, we're out.